Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Will the U.S. Supreme Court steer to the right on several social issues before it in the new fall term? Today, the Supreme Court hears a case on removing the limits on campaign donations by individuals, a case that some are calling the next Citizens United. The court will also hear cases on abortion and contraception and religion and more. We will talk about some of the issues before the U.S. Supreme Court and issues about the U.S. Supreme Court with a constitutional scholar who is the author of a new book, In the Balance: Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, October 8th. And we will welcome any questions you have about the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court and how the justices arrive at their decisions. And we'll wonder, just a general question, do you have faith in the U.S. Supreme Court? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Mark Tushnet, the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, a prominent scholar of constitutional law and legal history. He is the author of many books and articles, most recently In the Balance: Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I want to start with some of the news of the day before we go a little bit more into your book and the issues you cover in the book. The U.S. Supreme Court began hearing arguments for its new fall term yesterday, and today it will hear a campaign finance related case, McCutcheon versus the Federal Elections Commission. Some are describing this as the new Citizens United. Can you tell us what the facts are in this case?
Sure. Just a little background. Citizens United said that the First Amendment barred Congress from saying that you couldn't, placing limits on how much money you could spend yourself in support of another, of a candidate, in what are called independent expenditures. The McCutcheon case involves contributions to candidates. And the court historically has said it's okay, doesn't violate the First Amendment, to limit contributions to candidates because there's a risk of corrupting them. What Congress did was to say, well, you can provide a limited amount. You can give a limited amount to any individual candidate. Let's say it's $2,000. But then it said, in addition to limiting the amount you can give to any individual candidate, it provided what's called an aggregate limit, say $50,000. So you can give $2,000 each to 25 candidates. What McCutcheon wants to do is to give $2,000 to 60 candidates. And so he would exceed the aggregate limits. And he's saying that that's unconstitutional if it's not going to corrupt the first candidate to give that person $2,000. It's not going to corrupt the 60th candidate to give that person $2,000. And the court's going to consider whether McCutcheon's argument is a good one.
Yeah, and if I... It's not, if I'm understanding it, or help me understand it,
sure,
that it's the political contributions to the individual candidates, but also to political parties. And critics are saying that, you know, if you start letting various political parties get a bunch of unlimited donations, that that can just be funneled to candidates to exceed the limits anyway.
Right. Mm. The basic reason for these kinds of aggregate limits is to prevent people from working around the limitations on individual contributions. And the kind of thing you describe, that is, large contributions to parties can be used as ways of, you put it, funneling large amounts to candidates, thereby the supporters of the legislation, say, raising the risk of corruption of the candidates themselves.
So what does the Citizens United decision tell us about how this McCutcheon case might be decided?
There are two things to say. One is, technically, the court has treated contributions to candidates differently from independent expenditures. So, as a technical matter, maybe Citizens United doesn't say all that much about this case. What Citizens United did say was that the only reason Congress can have to restrict money flowing into campaigns is a concern about corruption. And they were very skeptical about other direct corruption, buying a legislator's vote, basically. And they were very skeptical about other kinds of concerns that would motivate campaign finance regulation. So that part of Citizens United, the skepticism about limiting money in campaigns, does have some resonances with the problem in McCutcheon.
Yeah. So, do you have? Do you have any analysis on how the justices might go on this one?
I think it's reasonably clear that there's a majority of the justices are quite skeptical about restrictions on campaign finance. And typically, one says about the Roberts Court that the swing vote is Anthony Kennedy. In campaign finance cases, Justice Kennedy has been one of the most vigorous critics of restrictions on campaign finance. So sort of going in, you'd have to assume that it was likely that the court would strike down this aggregate restriction, finding that the risk of corruption, of buying legislators' votes through contributions, was not large enough. On the other hand, the law regarding direct contributions to candidates is much more firmly established than the law was about independent expenditures. And so one or two of the conservatives might find the weight of precedent so substantial that they would uphold the restriction.
What are some of the other most watched cases before the court this fall?
There are two abortion-related cases, although one is in this very peculiar procedural posture, and we don't really know what's going to happen to it. The other one, which is directly before the court, involves the latest in a series of cases involving restrictions on, call them demonstrations, outside of abortion clinics. The restrictions are imposed because legislators or city councils think that having anti-abortion protesters outside of the clinics will intimidate women who are going to obtain what are lawful abortions. The court has upheld these restrictions. They say you can't have a demonstration within some limited number of feet of the entrance to the clinic. The courts upheld these restrictions in a series of cases, all of which are very closely divided. This is another case where the composition of the Roberts Court is different from the composition of the courts that decided those cases. And so there's reason to think that the court will say, well, no, the First Amendment does prohibits cities from saying you can't get that close to a clinic with a demonstration.
I'm looking at a piece in the LA Times where the writer was saying the Supreme Court's conservative bloc has a clear chance to shift the law to the right on abortion, contraception, religion, and campaign funding. Would you agree with that assessment?
In terms of having an opportunity, yes. They have on their docket cases in those areas where, if the five votes are there, they could, as the writer puts it, shift the doctrine to the right. And in both the campaign finance case and the abortion protest case, I think there's a good chance that will happen. I should note that it's the abortion protest case is a case not about access to abortions directly. They're not about state laws restricting access to abortion. It doesn't involve Roe and Wade itself. Rather, it involves protests and the First Amendment in connection with abortion clinics.
We are talking with Mark Tushnet. He is a professor of law at Harvard Law School. He is a constitutional scholar. He is also the author of In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. And we will talk to him more about the Roberts Court and what looking at past decisions might tell us about future decisions. And we'll welcome your questions for him about issues before the court, about issues involving the court. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, 21 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, October 8th. The U.S. Supreme Court began hearing arguments in a new batch of cases yesterday. And today, justices will be hearing oral arguments in a campaign finance case that's being called the Next Citizens United. We are talking with the author of a new book about the Supreme Court, which is about how this group of justices has tended to behave and what could be coming in the future. And we're welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mark Tushnet is the author of In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. Well, Professor Tushnet, why don't we talk a little bit, since we're talking about the conservative bloc on the court. Let's talk about the conservative bloc. What motivates the conservative bloc to make decisions conservatively? Isn't the law the law?
Chief Justice Roberts famously in his nomination hearings said that the job of the justices was to simply call balls and strikes. As if it were a mechanical or a sort of objective endeavor. Even he has regretted making so much of the metaphor, because really everybody who thinks about the court knows that in the most difficult and controversial cases, there's a lot of judgment that needs to be exercised. And that judgment comes out of broad political visions that the justices have. We call them conservative and liberal. They get those visions because of the way they have been socialized, the kinds of jobs they've had, their general political orientations. And then they bring those to the interpretation of the Constitution. Both liberals and conservatives do that, and it happens now that there's a conservative majority on the court, and so we see the court implementing this large-scale conservative philosophy of government. If liberals were in control, we'd see liberals doing that. I think it's important to emphasize, though, that these philosophies or ways of thinking about government are political in that we can call them conservative or liberal, but they're not partisan political in the sense that they're not looking to see what John Boehner wants to do or what Barack Obama wants to do. They have this idea of what conservatism and liberalism mean in our constitutional system, and that's what they're trying to work out.
Well, we have a comment on Facebook. Bill, a listener, says, I used to think of the court as mainly nonpartisan. Since Bush v. Gore, it's clear to me that it's just another political branch of government. What do you have to say to Bill?
I find it quite interesting as a constitutional scholar that the one case that the public always reverts to in these conversations is Bush against Gore. That is a case where the only explanation is that the justices were acting as political partisans, both the majority and the dissenters, I'd say. And that is clearly shaped the way people think about the court today. I don't think that, as I just said, I don't think that in the run of cases the justices are acting as political partisans, but they are acting as people who hold general views, conservative or liberal, about the way we ought to have, the kind of government we ought to have. So in that sense, maybe they are just another political branch of the government, but the kind of politics they're concerned with is different from the kinds of politics we're seeing going on in the controversy over the shutdown and the debt limit.
We have callers online. Mike in Oconomowoc is with us. Hello, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just kind of wanted to know if there's been a period in U.S. history where you have seen a number of justices come on the court of such a sharply conservative background, and then immediately following that, a number of justices come onto the court that are of what would be considered generally to be a fairly liberal leaning background, that happening over such a short period of time, how that may affect the court, at least as it's seen by you.
Do you follow that, Professor Tushnet?
Yeah. So our system is set up so that the appointments to the court are done through a political process. The president nominates them and the Senate confirms them. What that means is that the composition of the court is going to reflect the composition of the presidency and the Senate. They call them the political branches. What we're seeing now is the development of politics in the political branches of a sort that is new, quite ideologically organized and highly polarized. And what that means is that there is likely to be the same kind of ideological polarization on the court if the next nominee is a Democratic nominee who replaces one of the conservatives on the court. Then I think it's likely that we'll see a pretty sharp swing in the direction of the court's work. And that's, again, because of the way we've set things up to connect the court to our political system.
Go to Ray in Milwaukee next. Hello, Ray.
Good morning. I call the Supreme Court now just the Supreme crap. Over the last 10 years, every decision has been mostly right-leaning. Even the Obamacare ruling, I think, was a ruling to give billions of dollars to insurance companies, and thereby in the future we will never have a public option. They locked that into law as a right-leaning thing. But I was speaking with my mother about this. Why don't we have some average citizens on this court instead of these legal titans who all they can think about is what comes out of their legal books? They have no consideration about how their rulings play out with the average people. For instance, when they decided to do eminent domain, that was a few years back. If a town decides your house, even though you've lived there for 200 or 300 years, If they decide they can make more money on that plot of land, they have every right to tear it down.
Ray, because we're coming up on our news break, Professor Tushnet, I'm going to jump in and maybe just have you address why don't we have ordinary citizens who know what these decisions mean to ordinary citizens sitting on the court?
I want to change that a little bit. The current court is a very unusual court in that it's composed of people whose prior careers have been as academics and judges. It used to be that we had people on the court who had contact with ordinary people because they were politicians, former governors. Earl Warren was governor of California before he was appointed to the Supreme Court. Hugo Black was a senator before he was appointed to the Supreme Court. We've apparently lost that tradition, and there is, as the caller suggests, some loss to our jurisprudence from having only sort of isolated judges as the people who become Supreme Court justices.
We will hold it there for now, as we will check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we'll continue talking about some of the issues before the U.S. Supreme Court. It started its fall term this week, talking about the makeup of the court and how this group of justices has tended to rule in the past. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your views. We're wondering if you have faith in the U.S. Supreme Court. Why or why not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about issues before and issues involving the U.S. Supreme Court, and we are welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 7:37 on this Tuesday, October the 8th. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court will be hearing a case on removing the limits on campaign donations by individuals, a case that some are calling the next Citizens United. The court is also going to be hearing a number of cases on social issues, including abortion, contraception, religion, and more. We are talking about the fall term, the new fall term that the U.S. Supreme Court begins this week, and talking about the makeup of the court and how this group of justices has tended to rule or behave in the past and what that might tell us about what could happen in the future. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Mark Tushnet. He is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. He's a scholar of constitutional law and legal history. He is the author of many books and articles. His newest book is In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. I was thinking, Professor Tushnet, maybe we should just have you describe for us the Roberts Court.
Sure. Of course, there are a lot of ways to describe it. There are, it's a court with five conservative justices and four liberals and the like. I think for looking for the future, the best way to think about the Roberts Court is that it's one in which three of the justices are the most important ones going forward.
Who are the three most important?
For the moment, probably Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is the swing vote, as everybody describes him. On most issues, the other four conservatives will vote in a fairly predictable way, and the four liberals will vote in a fairly predictable way. And so a lot depends on what Justice Kennedy thinks, and he is slightly more moderate than the other Republican appointees. Then there's Chief Justice Roberts, who is in some ways the savviest member of the conservative group, and he serves as a kind of glue to hold them together and will be the leader of the conservatives going forward. And then finally, there's Justice Kagan, who serves on the liberal side, the same kind of function that the Chief Justice serves on the conservative side. She is pretty clearly on a course to becoming the both intellectual and sort of social leader, organizational leader of the court's liberals. At the moment, there are only four of them, which means that she can't be in control of the court in some strong sense. But both she and Chief Justice Roberts are in their 50s and are going to be on the court for a long time. So the story for the future is how this conflict between Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kagan will play itself out as the court's composition changes.
Yeah. Well, what kind of conflict? Describe that for us.
Well, the conflicts are conflicts not of personality, but of philosophies of government, of over what they think the proper role of legislatures is in connection with individual rights, and what they think the proper role of the Supreme Court is in imposing limits on what legislatures can do. Now, those philosophies fall into generally conservative and liberal patterns. So Justice Kagan generally thinks that Congress and legislatures have a lot of power to do things in the service of the public good, but also thinks that there are significant individual rights protections in the Constitution. Chief Justice Roberts is much more skeptical about the scope of government power and has a different set of individual rights that he focuses primarily on. Just as a sort of crude kind of example, in the abortion context, the liberals will say there's a woman's right to choose and the fetus's right to life is subordinated to that. And conservatives will emphasize the fetus's right to life and de-emphasize the woman's right to choose or ideas of women's equality.
So a recent article in Slate speculated that Justice Kagan will eventually be the court's leader, the Chief Justice. Do you, your thoughts on that?
Well, she may be the leader of the court if there's another liberal appointee to the court so that there are enough liberals to make it a majority. And I do think, and I talk about this in my book, I do think that we might then start talking about the Kagan court, not that she would become Chief Justice, because Chief Justice Roberts will stay there until he, age leads him to retire. The leadership of the court, the center of gravity of leadership, might shift from the Chief Justice to Justice Kagan.
And to talk a little bit about the role of the Chief Justice, how does that influence the court in any way?
There are two things to say about the Chief Justice. One, generally about Chief Justice's roles, and the other about Chief Justice Roberts. The formal role of the Chief Justice is relatively limited. When he's in the majority, he gets to assign opinions, that is to say, to ask justices if to write the opinions. And that can be an important power because you can assign the opinion to a judge who is leaning the other way, or you might be concerned would not stay with the majority, or you could assign it to a judge who would write an extremely strong opinion for a conservative point of view. So that is a significant power. But the other aspect of leadership on the court is associated with personality, not really with position. And this is sort of an informal leadership role, the kind of social leadership or the glue that holds people together. Chief Justice Roberts is a very outgoing, friendly, and quite smart person. And so he's able to perform for the conservatives that kind of leadership role. Justice Kagan, on the other side, has a quite similar personality, very extroverted and very smart, and so can perform that role on the liberal side. That kind of leadership, I want to emphasize, comes out of personality, not out of official position. And so while Chief Justice Roberts is the, call him, social leader of the conservatives, it's not because he is Chief Justice. It's because he's got the kind of personality that he does.
We have a lot of other callers, so let's go to Walker in Eau Claire. Hello, Walker.
Hi, Joey. Great show today, by the way. I really enjoy it. I've got a question. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is getting to sort of the end of her career, or at least has alluded to it anyway. What kind of position do you think she's going to take, or what sort of move do you think she's going to make in the next few years to sort of ensure that there is at least a liberal spot to take over her role if she decides to step down from the court? Thanks.
Justice Ginsburg did an interview that was published over the weekend in which she made it clear that she has no present intention to retire. She's in good health. She says she'll make her decisions on a year-by-year basis. She also says that she expects that there will be a Democratic president elected in 2016, and so she's not concerned about staying into the term of a Republican president who might appoint a conservative to replace her. So at least from her point of view, she's going to stay until she feels unable to do the job, and she's not concerned that her replacement will shift the ideological composition of the court.
Mm-hmm. Is there a conservative justice that's anywhere close to retiring?
Both Justices Kennedy and Scalia are in their late 70s. Both seem to be in pretty good health, and I don't think either one is likely to want to retire to give a Democratic president an opportunity to replace them. Certainly Justice Scalia has said that he doesn't want to do that. He said he wouldn't want somebody appointed who would, as he put it, undo his life's work. And so I don't think, if I were to make a guess, I don't think that there'd be another vacancy on the court during President Obama's term. But the health of relatively elderly people is often fragile, and unexpected things can happen. As I say, I wouldn't predict a vacancy on the court in the next 2 years, but it might occur.
What questions do you have about the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, or how rulings, decisions are made? Do you think that justices on the Supreme Court should be exactly like umpires, or is there any room for ideology or partisan sympathies? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are talking with Mark Tushnet. He is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, a constitutional law scholar, and the author of In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court under Chief Justice John Roberts. Our guest is a constitutional scholar, Mark Tushnet. He is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of many books and articles. His most recent book, In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. And I actually did want to follow up with you, Professor Tushnet, on the Justice Roberts' decision with the Affordable Care Act. Our caller before news alluded to that that ruling that upheld Obamacare. How surprising was that? That wasn't it Justice Roberts who was the swing vote on that?
Yes, he was. And in a surprising way, actually, it was not just surprising that he voted to uphold it, but the doctrine he invoked came as a surprise to most observers and, according to reports from inside the court, to his conservative colleagues. I have a chapter in my book about the Affordable Care Act decision, and what had happened was there were two ways of defending the statute, one under Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce, and everybody had focused on that. And Chief Justice Roberts said, along with his conservative colleagues, that Congress didn't have the power to require people to purchase insurance using its commerce power. But then he broke from them and said, but if you regard the payment that you have to make if you don't buy insurance as a tax, then it's constitutionally permissible under Congress's power to tax. That, as I say, came as a surprise to his colleagues, who reportedly were extremely angry at what they regarded as his change in position or his betrayal of the conservative view in the case. I have an analysis. It's hard to go into in detail in this kind of setting, in which I end up saying, I think what he actually did was to behave, as he said he would, like an umpire. One of the cases was a ball. One of the approaches was a ball. The other was a strike, and he called them the way he saw them. Working out the metaphor is messy in the context. But he was not. What's interesting about this is that he was not being driven by an ideological view or a narrowly partisan view that Republicans hate Obamacare, therefore it's got to be unconstitutional. He did not take that position.
Bill on Facebook asks, wasn't the Obamacare decision a lot more about political horse trading than legal precedent?
That's a view that is prevalent in commentary about the case. I just want to note here, the horse trading is said to be that the Chief Justice cast his vote in order to preserve something like the long-term reputation of the court. I don't think that's right, because it's just completely up in the air to me, and I think probably to anybody, what decision would have been better for the long-term reputation of the court. You know, if the Affordable Care Act turns out to be a failure, then upholding it may turn out to be seen as a failure on the part of the Supreme Court. If it turns out to be a success, then the court's reputation will be burnished. But at the time he had to make a decision, he didn't know and couldn't know what was going to be in the court's long-term interest. So I actually don't think that kind of explanation works to account for the vote that the Chief Justice cast.
Let's go to another caller, Chris in Milwaukee. Hello, Chris.
Does the law professor think Roe versus Wade will be overturned or will be preserved? I might note, about 7 years ago, I watched Charlie Rose and law professor Jeff Rosen quietly said, I think it's going to be overturned. Does the guest agree?
The current court, I think, pretty clearly will not overturn Roe and Wade. Justice Kennedy, who would be on this issue, the swing vote, has, as he put it, crossed the Rubicon on that issue in 1991 or 92. If a Republican president appoints somebody to replace one of the liberals on the court, then I think the answer is yes, it will be overturned. The votes are not quite there yet to do it. They may never be there, depending on, again, what the composition of the court in the future is. But it's a very close case, and one vote on the court could make a difference.
So help us understand why another conservative justice on the court would overturn Roe v. Wade. How does a conservative justice view the Constitution differently than a liberal justice?
Well, specifically with respect to Roe and Wade, what Republican presidents have looked for in their nominees is what they have come to call reliability. And what reliability means, one the central component of reliability is a commitment to the view that Roe and Wade was wrongly decided. More generally, what they're looking for are nominees who will be reliably conservative across the board. But again, Roe and Wade is at the heart of that. Sort of built into our political system. We use a political process to nominate the justices. It's not surprising to find presidents thinking in political terms when they make those nominations.
Well, let's go back to the present term. We started a little bit with that. Is there anything else that's on the docket? Something that will be heard that we should be watching for?
The one other case that hasn't yet come up is a case called Noel Canning, which involves the president's power to make recess appointments, to appoint people to agencies when the House and Senate are not in session. The underlying issue is quite technical, and in some ways, when you read the lower court opinions, it seems quite bizarre what they're saying. But the deeper issue is that it raises issues about the breadth of presidential power. And we know from the George W. Bush administration that Republicans who thought about the Constitution had a very expansive view of the president's power. They called it the unitary executive theory. The Supreme Court hasn't said much about the unitary executive theory, but Noel Canning is a case that allows them to think about and say something about the breadth of presidential power. And it will be interesting to see how or whether Republican nominees who come out of a tradition where they defended expansive presidential power will continue to do that when the president whose power they are defending is not George W. Bush, but Barack Obama.
So we have less than 30 seconds. Can we expect a lot more 5-4 decisions coming from this U.S. Supreme Court?
In less than 30 seconds, I think the answer is pretty clearly yes.
Yeah, and we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us. Mark Tushnet is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, a prominent scholar of constitutional law and legal history, the author of In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Robin Cherry for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.